Hey, podcast listeners. You're listening to a recording made in Los Gatos on the 25th of May, 2015. That's Memorial Day, and it's a different date from the one you're about to hear, which is for the broadcast listeners. Anyway, thanks for downloading. This is GeekSpeak for Saturday, May 30th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm geek translator Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe, a teacher, web developer, traveler, and music geek. Hey, Ben.
Hey, hey.
And Lyle Troxell, a maker, photographer, father, and senior user interface engineer at Netflix.
Hello, Ben and Bonnie.
Hello,
that's
Lyle.
A fancy title.
It is, isn't it?
Senior user interface, what was it?
Something. Engineer.
Engineer.
Yeah, it means that I think before I program. That's the engineering part. And the senior user interface means that I'm a high-level engineer, meaning I'm not a beginner.
That's I don't have senior. Either of those titles.
And then and the thing is, everybody at Netflix is a senior person because that's who they hire. So if you're out of school and you want a job at Netflix, sorry. But I think that's all. A UI, user interface, means that I interact with the actual thing that you interact with. So a lot of what Netflix does is like streaming video and all that stuff. But they actually click your buttons and choose things and pick around and poke around and find things and browse and find, search and all that. That's the stuff I do.
And that's called, in the industry, it's called UI.
It's UI or UX. Yeah.
They're both kind of synonymous. But aren't they different things?
I don't think so. I think, what do you think, Ben? You think UX? So UX is for user experience, and UI is for user interaction.
Interface.
Or interface.
Yeah, so user interface has been around for a long time. People have used that term UI. But then as we've been interacting with things and caring more about things like animation and the entire experience of the user, it was needed to coin a different term to specifically talk about all of that rather than just the visual interface that you can click on and read and all that stuff. Mm-hmm.
So it's gone beyond just a particular symbol or something that you click on the computer to just sort of the overall experience.
Yeah, I think it was the distinction I think was more important earlier on when not as many people were thinking about the entire experience of an app or of a program or whatever it is, or a product of any sort. But I don't know. I kind of agree with you, Lyle. Fundamentally, conceptually, they're the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. One is just thinking about it at a broader experience, that's all. Which I think is what you have to do in any kind of vocation. You have to think about the broader implications of what you're doing. And so UX just kind of denotes that in a formal way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe we'll take that up again as a subject in a future week. But right now, I want to get us started on GeekSpeak today with a couple of security breaches and how they were handled.
A how not to handle stuff segment.
Oh, how not to do it.
Maybe we should have that a regular segment on GeekSpeak on how not to handle stuff. Because it seems like every week there's a company that not only do they mess up in some way, they then mess up again when they're trying to handle the issues that come
fallout.
Up after. The fallout, that's where I was looking for.
The blowback, if you will.
So first, we'll talk about CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is one of the largest regional health insurers in the United States. And recently, as in Thursday, May 21st, 2015, they confirmed a major security breach, and they are estimating it affected as many as 1.1 million customers. Do you know when this happened?
No.
Well, I would assume last week because then they notified
us. Right now we're talking about it, right?
Right, because that's what happens.
Yeah,
so
that's
the hack takes place, and then they take 2 days to really figure it out, and then they inform everybody because it's the thing that you should do.
That's what should happen.
Yes.
More often, it takes a couple weeks, a month. This attack happened in June of last year, 2014. It is May of 2015 right now.
So practically a year.
Almost a year ago.
So that's, what were they doing in between? I don't understand.
I don't know. Sitting on their laurels or not realizing that the attack quite took place.
And so what happened with the attack? The attack was revealing of
It was just a cyber attack that compromised their security and got, basically the attackers got a bunch of information, including usernames. They didn't contain member passwords, but they did contain things like credit card details, social security numbers, medical claims, employment details,
oh dear,
or financial so records.
Oh, man.
So how can you sit on that for a year?
I don't know.
That seems like a real violation.
I think in California, there's a rule you have to respond a shorter period of time than that. So I'm surprised that they were able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe they're not California-based. It says a regional.
Hmm.
They're a regional powerhouse.
I got Washington, D.C. is where they're out of.
Oh, wow. Well,
but, okay. they insure tons and tons of people.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a Blue Shield customer. I wonder if I've got a problem.
See, I don't understand if this is Blue Cross, Blue Shield, it says Care First, Blue Cross, Blue Shield.
And is it all one umbrella organization, kind of like Hardee's and Carl's Jr.
No
are
idea.
Secretly the same?
All I can tell you is Care First doesn't have a space between it, Blue Cross doesn't have a space between it, and Blue Shield doesn't have a space between it, which is just really confusing to me. I don't understand why they don't have spaces.
You know that GeekSpeak doesn't have a space between it, right?
Well, that's true.
But why is everyone else doing it?
That's one title. There are two words. There's geek and there's speak and there's no space. But if we were like geek space speak productions or something, it would just...
It would really frustrate you.
It's just weird. I don't know why that irks me so much.
Well, all right. So basically they sat on their hands for a year. Violation number one.
Something like that. It may be that it took them months to figure out that they got hacked. Because that happens, you know?
That's going to be sad.
But regardless, they should have at least, even if they just figured it out, they should have at least acknowledged the gap a little bit more, like, you know, oh man,
hey guys,
we're
seeing
up.
Something. Hold on a second here.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a possibility that though the exploit happened a year ago, that they hadn't cottoned to it until much later.
It's hard to tell with things like this because companies really don't have a lot of incentives to disclose information about them other than just the bare minimum that they can get away with from a PR perspective. Although right. they're probably handling their PR not all that well right now.
Because every breach is just an embarrassment.
Every breach is not so great. So I've got one more how not to handle stuff. Thing so
this week and how not to handle it.
Got
you know,
one too.
We could do you really? Yeah. We could start a whole show on this. Actually, we could have a geek speak and then how not to handle stuff.
What's your second world. Example?
Starbucks. Now last week we talked about Starbucks and issue where you could
thing.
Potentially use gift cards to buy other gift cards and yada yada, right?
Yeah.
So that would be if someone managed to compromise your Starbucks account. This is a completely different exploit, and it has to do with a race condition. Do you want to, Lyle, explain what a race condition is?
Yeah, what's a race condition?
Yeah, in programming, when you have software that's running scripts, especially on multiple processors, you have a situation where one script can try to do something and the other side or the other application can
it's
try to do
ready
something.
Yet.
They try to do it at the same time, and you have a condition where they're racing against each other, and you just get side effects. An example of that would be, it's a hard example.
Here, I've got a good real-world example. We're sitting around a table right now.
Yeah.
Hey, would you guys hand me one water bottle?
Right.
And you're, okay, I just got two water bottles because
bottle. Okay.
Right.
You were both fast, right?
Right.
Now, what would ideally happen is one of you would handle the water bottle and then the other would say, no, I don't need to do that because, Ben already has a water bottle.
Or Ben could sit in a situation and say, who's available to hand me a water bottle? And we both say yes, which you can take, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd say, okay, Bonnie, give me a water bottle.
Yeah, that's another
so
way
that
to deal
with
it.
That would be handling the race condition by
okay.
doing
that's
the message
one way
protocol.
That it's handled.
Yeah. Now, one really difficult thing with payment systems is that you have potentials for race conditions all the time. Because if you have a lot of money and different transactions going into and out of a particular account very, very close time-wise to each other, you want to make sure that you protect against that. So if I try and withdraw $100 from my account and someone, let's say a friend of mine also does the same thing, legitimately, and I only have $150 in my account, the bank will correctly say no.
To one of them.
To one of them, and yes to the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whichever it determines got there first. So here's how the Starbucks vulnerability works. So the guy who was doing this to kind of as a proof of concept, right, just checking. Because security researchers do this all the time. They check the security of systems. It's kind of what they do in their spare time as well as for work.
Mm.
So he bought three $5 gift cards, and he was trying to see if he could transfer $5 from one gift card away to one account and to the other account at the same time.
So he has $5 in one account and he's going to move $5. He's going to move $10 away from that account.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So
fun.
Gift
yeah.
card
assuming,
one.
I'm assuming
has a,
he did it.
Gift card one, gift card two, gift card three. They all have a balance of $5.
Yeah.
And he sends a request And it's also difficult to replicate this because with race conditions, computers are generally pretty
right,
fast.
Yeah.
You got to do it just right.
Yeah.
So he tried a bunch of times. He was unsuccessful. One of the final times he was going to try, it worked. He managed to transfer $5 out of account one to account two and $5 out of account one to account three at basically the same time.
So he started with $15 and he ended up with $20.
Exactly.
Not bad.
$10 on two accounts.
You
and
do that every day.
The other one.
That's pretty nice.
Right.
Well,
so
how long did it take him?
So
it took him 12 hours.
So what did he do? Did he, know, write a script to do this over and over and over again? Because
no,
I mean,
he contacted them and told them about the flaw.
He tried to.
Tried to? What do you mean he tried to?
It turns out it's really, really difficult to contact Starbucks.
Excuse me,
technical
you got a problem?
Support. In fact,
thank you for calling.
In fact, I think if I remember correctly, a representative told him that he couldn't. It's impossible. They're just they're. Tech people are not available to be contacted.
So what did he do?
He disclosed the vulnerability because what else are you going to do?
He didn't have another avenue.
And what did Starbucks say?
They sued him.
They didn't. They did not sue him.
That would be awful.
They did not sue him. But
he said, "Here, thanks. Here's a gift card."
Right.
Have fun.
Right. No, they asked for $5 back.
He gave him $5. He took him $5.
Oh, also,
that'll be $5.
By the way, in order
they should have given him $30,000 and thanked him.
So, it is possible that his account was showing a $10 balance on gift card two and a $10 balance on gift card three, and it was actually an error in the view or something like that, and the balance actually wasn't that way, right? So he went to Starbucks and he bought something for just a teeny bit more than $15 for like $16.70 or something, and indeed he got it, and he had a little money left on his gift card. So that is the proof that that the vulnerability worked and that his exploit of it worked. So
So doing that, he just did a crime.
Well, technically, yes.
Yeah.
But a very small amount of money.
Does it make it $1.70? And you know what? Yeah. I'll bet if Starbucks knocked at his door and said, hey, can we have our $1.70 back?
He totally wouldn't give it back.
He would probably say, yeah, sure.
So is Starbucks responding yet?
Yes.
Good.
By claiming that he's engaged in fraudulent activity and blah, 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 blah. And
What are they thinking?
I don't know. Oh, I mean, he basically just said, yo, Starbucks, you've got a payment system security vulnerability. Here, it costs you $1.70, and now you can fix it. And so, indeed, Starbucks did fix it, but instead of saying...
I'm glad they fixed it.
Yes, they claimed to fix it.
Oh.
And instead of saying, hey, thanks, they said, forget you.
Yeah,
beat it,
that's
kid.
Ridiculous.
Beat it.
Huh.
So right. Anyway,
so
how not to do it? And what they should have done is said, "Ooh gosh, thanks. Let's keep it on the down low, shall we?"
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to fix that.
They
right
should
now.
Have had a way to be contacted to have these kinds of vulnerabilities. I mean, actually, what the big companies do, like if you look at Google and Facebook and Mozilla, the way they do it is they actually offer a bug bounty program.
That's right.
So there's an incentive for security researchers when they find a bug to basically cash it in. Say, "Here's the vulnerability. Here's the proof of concept." And then Google or whoever it is will give them $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000. And all of their products get more secure. And any potential risks that could have been even larger in terms of monetary loss.
So that makes sense to me as a tech company that you'd have that idea and have that sort of a program. Starbucks may think that they're in the business of selling coffee and may not really think of themselves as a tech company.
They are.
And therefore not really think of themselves as needing to be on the dime responsive. And as we've seen with Home Depot and Target, that's a mistake.
Yes, that is why it's in our How Not to Handle Stuff segment.
How not to handle it.
So anyway, I hope that's the end of our security news.
So at least at some level, those companies are speaking. Because of course, what if the company's not even aware that the problem emerged?
Oh, that's true.
So Bonnie, my next story actually is about that kind of situation where the company itself didn't even know the problem existed, that they had a flaw in their system. Anybody here used online dating services?
In fact, it's how I found my fella.
Really?
Yeah.
Congratulations
Thank
to that.
You.
That's
Thank
good
you.
Success.
Mm-hmm.
Ben,
indirectly
have you?
How I found my partner.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So
very indirect, but still.
I'm sorry. I've never really used them, but I've been very...
Wait, why are you apologizing
because
for that?
I was thinking it'd be a 3 out of 3. All the geeks use that, but I just...
You're a relic, Lyle.
I guess so. I'm a relic. I'm a father, so that's what happens. You become a relic quickly.
Why do you ask?
So there's a service called the Adult Friend Finder. Do you know the service?
I've heard of it.
Okay. I've heard of it as well.
Right. So it's kind of like a dating service. It's kind of like a hookup service, but it's this place where you'd share your personal information about who you are and what you're interested in, and then you'd hopefully find an adult friend that can share the same interest with you. And it's relatively popular and all of that. And recently, Channel 4 News, which is a channel in the UK, did some investigation and started playing around in the dark web, and this is the basically the.
The shady underworld.
The shady underworld of the internet. As it's like it needs one. It already is the shady underworld.
It's like dark matter. Most people don't know about it, but the people who do know a lot about it, it's the invisible internet, I guess.
So in playing around in this kind of secret forum and kind of getting connected, there was a hacker nicknamed Rog. R-O-R. It doesn't really matter. We'll call him Rog. It's odd naming. Yeah. He posted details that he has some user information from Adult Friend Finder for sale. And so
he has some information about adult friend finder users for sale.
And it turns out that the site currently boasts about 63 million users worldwide. So it's a lot of members.
Yeah.
And that's what they say. And then it bills itself as a thriving sex community. And the users, therefore, normally share a lot of personal data. And the information of about 3.9 million adult friend find members is available for sale in this dark web, meaning the data of that has been pulled out of their system and for sale. And it looks like the Adult Friend Finder didn't even know about this, that it had happened.
Yeah.
It's really a shame. In fact, the site seemed a little strange. This guy, Sean Harper, he was using it. He'd signed up, tried it out, seemed okay, but then thought, nah, this isn't really for me. And he went to delete his information.
Right.
And he had to give him all this private information, like his age and his interests and his, you know, income and all these different things. He, of course, could lie about that, but then you wouldn't find something that might match. So anyway, he deleted his account. So he thought the information had gone, it was safe and all that. And then he started getting spam emails, clearly using the address that he had used for Adult Friend Finder. Somebody had hacked it, and they'd been selling his data. So even though he tried to delete the data,
it was still there.
And then when the hackers got into the system, they were able to get his data out of it.
Oh, that's not good.
Dates of birth, zip codes, names, all that information. Tons of stuff, in fact, available. And this is one of those things that I'm really sensitive when you share your personal information, especially when you're motivated by that kind of movement of like trying to find people. You're lonely, you want to meet somebody, mm-hmm. and you're sharing information. The more you share, the more likely you'll find somebody that links up. It's kind of appropriate in that respect.
Right.
But it's really scary in the situation if they don't have the security down. So the other thing that's interesting is that this news channel did some research among the email addresses that they found for UK residents. They found 26,000 or about 27,000 email addresses with UK email address. They're just analyzing that.
Okay.
And of that, only 1,500 of them, so 27,000 email addresses, 1,500 of them were females. The rest were male.
Interesting.
So that's one of the first times we've seen a large public reference of how many males for females versus these sites. Hmm. It looks like there's a lot more women on the sites, obviously, than men at a 1,000 ratio, 10-to-1 ratio.
Yeah. Wow.
Huh. So I just thought it was kind of interesting.
I mean, so, there's a lot more fellas on the site.
A lot more fellas.
Yeah.
All right. So, depending on what you're looking for, may or may not be a good outlet for you.
So, Friend Finder Networks responded to this, and they appreciate the seriousness of the issue, and they say that we're already begin working closely with law enforcement, have launched a comprehensive investigation with the help of leading third-party forensics experts, and so on.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. It sounds like a good response.
Yeah. It's a good response. It's just that they didn't know about it first. So
that sucks.
Yeah. Okay. Blah. Well, let's talk about other kinds of tracking and other things happening in the geek news when we come back. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. And if you're a fan of this program, consider also checking out the 7th Avenue Project, which airs Sundays at noon at 88.9 or as a podcast from the talk section of KUSP.org. Every week, Robert talks with a bright mind in the arts or sciences, and then we all get to listen in. That's the 7th Avenue Project, Thinking Persons Radio, with Robert Pauly, tomorrow at noon on KUSP. You can also check out his website at 7thAvenueProject.com. That's 7thAvenueProject.com. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe. And Ben, let's talk about tracking in a different context on the subway.
Yes, indeed. So if your phone – now, the particular article that I'm covering right now, if you go on the website and you read it, you can find it at geekspeak.org. It's a little bit fear-mongering. It's kind of written in a very negative
light. And who wrote it? Where did it show?
It's on daily.com.
Okay.
And it's about research. Now, this research can be, if it were an exploit, could be considered fairly creepy, right? But the research itself, I actually find really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's a way of taking a whole bunch of data, if you can get the data, and figuring out location in an somewhat unusual way. So here's how it works. Pretty much everybody has a phone. Almost everybody has a smartphone, at least in a lot of major cities.
Enough people to make something like this work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we're talking specifically cities that have light rail or underground subway stations, train stations, things like that. So one of the things that makes this kind of public transportation unique is that it's underground. So you couldn't, say, use the GPS or something like that to figure out where a user is, right?
Right, right.
So that's point number one. But also you've got all of these different stops that are relatively close to each other, right? But always a little bit of a different distance.
Mm-hmm.
So this research basically says that if you can get people's the accelerometer data from people's phones, you can actually figure out what city they're in, even if you don't have any other data.
Just by when they go fast and when they go slow?
When they accelerate, when they decelerate, and also the particular vibrations that the phone might be subjected to by the train itself.
Hmm.
Because every particular subway system has different rails and different turns and everything.
It's figuring out what an album is by the length of the tracks on the album.
That's exactly it. That's exactly one of the pieces. And that's actually how the CDDB works. So the what is it called?
Content database.
Anyway, that's the thing that when you put a CD into your computer, which, you know, a lot of us don't have CD drives anymore, but if you were to put a CD into your computer and then iTunes or your media player of choice thinks for a second, mm-hmm. and it shows track one, track two, track three, track four, and then all of a sudden, magically, all of those track numbers go away and the real track numbers pop up. The way they do that...
The track title,
the artist, the length, all this, of this
all the info, yeah.
The way they do that is by sending the length of each track off to a database somewhere, and that database says, oh yeah, the album that has, you know, 4 minutes and 52 seconds, then 4 minutes and 46 seconds, then 5 minutes and 12 seconds, etc., that is the Beatles White Album or whatever it is.
Okay. So they're doing that with, they're being able to tell which city you're in by
subway stations.
The length of the time it takes to get from subway station to subway
Absolutely.
Station. Wow.
So that's one. There are also, like I mentioned, certain motion patterns that are distinctive, especially on certain subways versus others.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not an actual attack that's in the wild.
Yeah, why are they doing that? Why are they tracking that?
Well, I mean, you know, security researchers do that, right? They just look for ways of taking data of finding exploits and getting privileged access to devices, one, or taking data that you might collect from those kinds of things or find somewhere else and find a way to get more information from that. It's just kind of, that's the way that entire world works, right? So this research is really interesting, and they actually did perform some experiments in China tracking volunteers that were carrying smartphones through the subways in Nanjing. And their tracking accuracy actually got up to 92%, between 70 and 92%.
That's pretty good. And so for people who are volunteering to be tracked, not a problem. But I suppose the Daily Dot is intimating that this could happen against your will and be careful and don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you try?
Don't follow that advice.
About that, yeah.
It's mainly taking what is generally interesting research and has a lot of different implications. I mean, this is an application of machine learning that I find quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking that research and saying, ah, if this were used for evil, then da 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 da. And that seemed to, put itself into the tone of the article.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you do read this article, there's a little more information in the article. It's a really interesting topic. Don't get too freaked out or anything, because this is not anything that anyone is
currently. It's a what-if article.
It's a what-if article based on what I think is pretty cool research.
Okay. So. All right. So that's interesting, right, that we could be tracked in so many different exciting ways.
If someone has, an app on our smartphone.
Right, yeah. Well, speaking of apps and the kind of access that that gets people, you've discovered something that the NSA was up to or trying to get up to.
Yeah, I would say that Edward Snowden actually released this information.
It was not you.
It was not me.
He was like, Lyle, what a scoop.
Yeah, we're actually talking to Lyle from Russia right now.
I'm sweating profusely.
A new document was released recently by Edward Snowden's reporters, really, the people that are actually have the documentation that he has.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about a project that the NSA was running called Irritant Horn is the name of the project. Irritant
Horn. Terrible already.
Yeah, code name. And
why don't they just call it a Zub? What's this thing called? A Zub?
They got great. They got great names for their stuff. Yeah. This is basically a pilot project that was focused on intercepting traffic between people's phones and the app stores their phones were using. Of course, on they mostly talked about Samsung and Android in this one case. All the app stores are going to be a little bit different, but Android app stores are going to operate differently than iOS app stores.
So they're putting themselves in between the user and the app store.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, the reason that's a good place to be, if you can do it effectively, is that you can theoretically modify the app before it gets to the user. And then the user is using something that is modified. And of course, the idea being that they would insert their own code to be able to do things like access anything on the phone and report back, location, all of that stuff you'd potentially want to do if you were a spy agency.
So you're saying I download Angry Birds, the NSA happens to be in the middle, and then they put a version of Angry Birds that tracks my location on the subway.
It's Angry Birds plus plus NSA. Basically a different a modified version. Of course your phone does, you don't know as a user that it's not just Angry Birds, that it's something else.
Yeah.
They also in this report talk about an exploit they found in UC Browser. UC Browser is a web browser that's in Android type phones that's been around. It's actually the most popular browser on the planet because it's
the normal one, right? The default one.
It's the old default one, I should say. Prior to the most recent Android version, it was the default browser. Yes.
Now I think Chrome is the
default. They've moved to the Chrome. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
but UC Browser is still the largest browser in the world because it's in pretty much all over China's phones. So that's a large part of the population using smartphones. They're using this browser. And this browser was found, the NSA found a defect in it, and they've been taking advantage of it. Some people would say they've even, like, they've been weaponizing it, meaning they've taken advantage of it to use spying actions. They didn't tell the group that wrote it that there's a problem. They just said, hey, we can use this to our advantage. Mm. And they kept it secret and took advantage of it. Now, NSA has been doing that a lot, or showing a lot that they do that kind of thing, where they take it, see a vulnerability, instead of fixing it and being a good citizen, they just use the vulnerability for their own spying efforts. The reason that's problematic, of course, is that if they can find the vulnerability,
who else can find
it? Other people can use the vulnerability. Yeah. Other people that are, you know, criminal.
That's one of the reasons it's an
but really
issue,
isn't right? The only one you really worry about having it at the NSA.
Well, I actually as a no, I'm more worried about criminals having access
are
to
you?
That stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, because the truth, unless I think it's worse that government agencies are targeting citizens and doing kind of creepy things that later, from a social perspective.
Yeah, you expect it from a criminal.
Yeah, but from a how does my family and friends get affected?
Yeah.
The vulnerability existing and therefore a criminal taking advantage of somebody is emotionally more impactful for me because
okay.
It's close to my family.
So for you, it's like a in the NSA's effort to protect the society, they're making it vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. They definitely are. They've done that over and over again, and this is another case of that happening, which is kind of a shame. And, of course, because the public document is public, they're going to have to change that practice, which is good. So, again, yay for the documentation becoming public to fix these kind of horrible policies.
Right.
The other thing that they talked about, I'm sorry, to go on a little bit of the story, the other thing that the NSA wanted to do was take advantage of and override the servers that were hosting the app stores and actually infect the servers themselves, thereby getting data about the server, the app server. This is really interesting because you can profile quite a bit of information about a user by looking at what they've downloaded and used,
mm-hmm.
where they are,
mm-hmm.
their access to the system, because
right.
every time you ping the app store, which is kind of a normal process, you actually have to share with the app store your unique identifier,
right.
and therefore they know from where you were and basically your travel information if you have access to the server.
Ew.
And they were clearly trying to do that as well. All the servers they try to target are not in U.S. soil,
mm-hmm.
Which makes that activity, that's what the NSA should be doing as a spy agency.
Yeah, I guess so.
Potentially. That's what spies do.
So it's supposed to be on foreign soil so that we don't
right.
feel as creepy about
right.
it. It's other people, not us.
And, you know, everybody's doing it. I mean, it's hard to say whether that's a bad thing or not, but it's definitely scary.
Well, and are they actually doing this, or did they just have a go at it and went, oh, well, I guess that didn't work out?
It was a pilot project, so it's very possible that they stopped the pilot project.
Yeah.
Okay. The document lays out some information. They're running it from November 2011 to February 2012, so it was a short period.
Okay.
And they were doing this Five Eye workshop. This is the workshop they talked about this project, where they documented it,
mm-hmm.
and this was done in Australia and Canada. The workshops were held in Australia and Canada about how the system worked and how you could take advantage of it and use it.
So why? Okay.
Well, we won't get more into
Canadians.
That.
Canadians. All right. Boy, it sure is hard to feel secure even when you make your best attempts to do so, Ben.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Well said.
Can we have some good news at some point?
I don't know if there is any this
maybe,
time.
Maybe right. after this story.
In a future show, check out
a future
broadcast of Geek Speak. but for right now, I want to talk about making an attempt to wipe your presence clean.
Yeah, so my phone's getting a little old. Yeah. I have a Galaxy S3. It has the latest version of Android that CyanogenMod supports, and it occasionally will force quit randomly. I don't really know why. Oh.
Can I translate for you, Bunny?
Yeah.
Ben needs a new phone.
Yeah. I need a new phone.
Well, it shuts down on its own sometimes?
Yeah, it tends to shut down when I'm about 1 mile from my destination.
Mm. And you still need the key information
and
to
I'm
get
like,
you there.
Oh, what?
I don't know where I am now.
What exit was that? Oh, no. Okay, I'll just wait for this to reboot and take a guess, you know?
Yeah.
So, when I change phones, ideally, I want to take this phone and I want to give it off to somebody else, right? So in order to do that, I'm, of course, going to do a factory reset.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out there's some research that shows that although it's probably not a problem, it won't probably be a problem for me, it is theoretically actually possible to get a lot of information from a phone that has been factory reset. So these Cambridge University researchers basically studied that security feature, the wiping it, the factory reset feature,
mm-hmm.
and found that Android phones don't do the best job. So a couple things. The file storing decryption keys on devices were not erased during the factory reset. And
so what's the implication of that?
If you have access to that file, then you could recover certain things. And then with those particular files, brute force the user's PIN off of the device and then decrypt the device. I'm not really going to go into much more detail there, but suffice it to say that's not particularly good.
So you can kind of work your way back into having access to the whole file?
Yeah, actually. So what they found actually was in all of the devices that they tested that had the flawed factory reset, and they tested 26 secondhand Android phones, with Android version 2.3 to 4.3,
mm-hmm.
with five different handset makers. And they were actually able to recover the Google authentication tokens in all the devices with a flawed factory reset, and were able to access master tokens in 80% of those cases.
Oh, God.
Which, what that means is, after they do this, and then they reboot the phone, the phone will successfully resynchronize contacts and emails and all of that stuff, which is really
it's exactly
bad.
The opposite of what you want.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's not wiped at all.
So that's really bad, right? Now,
this must not happen when you actually reinstall the when you do a complete wipe and do an operating system install, right?
I don't think so, but I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. So
how do you tell if it's a flawed wipe or not?
I mean, it probably is a flawed wipe, but
just assume it is.
But it is important.
Potty humor ensues.
Is it important to say? It is important to say that when we're talking about these kinds of vulnerabilities, it doesn't necessarily mean that anybody could make use of these vulnerabilities
right.
easily, right?
Most so likely they won't, and all that.
If I wipe this and I, you know, sell it to somebody via Goodwill or
give it to electronics recycling center,
right?
Like in Santa Cruz County, there's Gray Bears,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, if I were a high profile individual, which I guess in this case, I'm glad to say I'm not, right? Then I might have to actually really be concerned about this. So if you're a politician, if you're a high-ranking official, or maybe someone who's high up at a large company, or somebody with a lot to lose,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
then you have to be a little bit more careful, right? Then you might want to consider, you know, maybe I shouldn't give this phone to somebody else. Maybe I should actually destroy it somehow, or you know, give it to somebody who will destroy it properly. So, yeah. Now, this is not particularly massively scalable, is basically what I'm
saying. Okay, but if you are listening and you're Jennifer Lawrence or ScarJo, maybe don't give away your used phone. Oh, ScarJo, I didn't know you were here. Well, thank goodness that now with modern keys and so on,
yes.
We don't have this problem with our cars, right?
Right, right. Of course, you'd be able to get access to your car instead of using your key. You can use electronic device, and there's no problems with those. Unfortunately, that's not true at all.
Oh no!
Yeah. So, I got a Leaf, right? So a relatively new vehicle, and it's got a little fob, a little electronic fob, but
key fob, yeah,
key fob, mm-hmm. just a little fob, and I keep it in my pocket all the time. And when I get near my car, it knows who I am, and it unlocks it when I try to unlock the door. It goes, oh, yep, click, and it unlocks it for me. Yeah. Because it could detect that I'm outside the car because I've got this thing in my pocket.
So, okay, that's immediately scary because I could have just snatched your fob and be walking by your car, and but it goes, you could, click, and you're like, yeah. Oh, apparently something happened. Maybe so, I can try the door and get into this thing.
It's been true for a while. You could take a fob and you can click the button, the alert button or something in the car, and the parking lot would beep and all that. Yeah. But theoretically, if I have my fob on me, you can't get into my car because the fob's on me and I'm not in front of the car.
And the other thing is, if you lose your fob, you probably will be able to figure that out, right? You're reaching your pocket. Oh, no, my fob's gone. Somebody else might have it.
So how do these things actually work? And it's actually kind of interesting, in my opinion, from an electrical perspective. The car is constantly putting a low-frequency beep out, 120 to 135 kilohertz, short range. It's kind of like RFIDs. It kind of does a low frequency, if you will. I mean, it's still higher than our sound, but low-frequency electronic sound. And it goes whoom and a whoom every once in a while. Mm. You can't hear this, of course. It's radio frequency. Mm-hmm. And the fob that listens to that goes, oh, I'm here. I recognize you. Right? Little communication.
Okay, so it's a little heartbeat thing.
That's right. Yeah, the heartbeat is very low range because it's low frequency and therefore it's low range. We're talking 15, 20 feet from the vehicle, probably less than that. It's designed to be only when you're outside the vehicle. In fact, you can detect what side of the vehicle you're on. So we're talking short range. That's the one step. The second thing is that the car has to have a lot of power to do that, but it's got a large battery, so it's okay. By the way, all cars that do this kind of fobless keyless entry thing do this. The key fob then hears this, recognizes it at its request, and then sends a UHF response that has a much longer range, maybe a football field distance. Mm. Do you remember old television sets that had a UHF?
I sure do.
That frequency range. Uh-huh. The reason that frequency is nice is that high frequency actually travels a lot farther with lower power. Mm. So the fob can go ping back with a high frequency. That can go about a football field away or so. And that's in the 315 to 433 megahertz range, so much higher frequency.
Wait, so then it's a bad idea, wouldn't it be, to have fobs pinging at a higher frequency because then you're more vulnerable to having someone else going, oh, let's help myself to this open car.
The reason they do this, of course, is that if you're finding your car in a parking lot and you want to unlock it or you want to turn the alarm on or something, from a ways away, you can click that button. It goes bleep, bleep. Right?
Oh, okay, yeah.
That uses the same radio.
So even if you're a few rows away, you can still like, oh, it's over there.
Right. So the car has two different, they also say the car has two different kinds of pings. It has an outside the car ping and an indoor the car ping. So if you get into the car, it pings you, the thing responds, and it knows, oh, you're inside the car. Mm-hmm. But the frequency the fob responds with is always high frequency and always long distance. The way the car knows where you are is that it only communicates with a whisper.
All right.
Okay. So it whispers, the fob goes,
I'm okay. Yeah. So the car is like, yo. And then the fob's like, yo.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. So here's the hack.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
you take a briefcase.
Okay.
And you in the briefcase, you put a receiver that receives the low frequency, hello. Uh-huh. And you put that by the car. Then you walk into the restaurant and you walk around with another briefcase. Those two briefcases take the low frequency, low range pulse, the whisper, transform that into a high frequency, basically a 2.5 gigahertz communication, which is like our Wi-Fi, to the other briefcase. That briefcase steps it back down again to low frequency and says, hello. And the long and the short of it is, the person in the restaurant walks around until the fob hears the whisper from its own car. But it's transported from a long distance with this new technology.
So the briefcases are sending the signal that the car is sending over to the briefcase in the restaurant.
Completely seamlessly, not decoded, just analog, just wireless.
And then the fob is like, oh, hey, I must be near my car, even though my friend...
And the car says, hello! Or the fob says, hello! Really loud. Yeah. The car can hear it from outside and says, cool, unlocks the door.
Ew.
So then you basically... As a pair, two people can unlock any vehicle they want by just following that person.
Okay, this is
then.
What? No,
then
what?
The briefcase person gets into the car. Now the briefcase receives the car's low frequency whisper and saying, "Are you inside?" And the briefcase sends the message across the Wi-Fi to the briefcase in the secondary briefcase in the restaurant. And the briefcase in the restaurant, of course, is next to you and says, uh-huh. "Are you inside?" And the ping goes, "Yeah!" The fob yells back, and it goes back to the briefcase, and the car starts up. And the thief drives away.
Well, hey, presto, why don't we all just do that right now? Well, it strikes me that that's a very elaborate hack.
I have a solution, though.
Okay.
A way to solve the problem.
Is just to ban briefcases.
Ban briefcases,
I'll tell you in a minute.
All right. Well, it is Geek Speak here on KUSP. We'll find out more about these impossible hacks that can't possibly happen. It's terrible. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. Earlier, Lyle, you asked, isn't there some sort of good news anywhere? And we... We lied to you. We said there was none. But Ben, you've actually got something.
I've got some good news. I really want to hear the end of Lyle's story, but I'll tell you about this first. So the Mars rover, Curiosity on Mars, it's been rolling around trying to take pictures with this particular instrument that shows the detailed texture of rocks. And it's had a little bit of a problem because it hasn't been able to focus automatically. So as you can imagine, if you're taking pictures and you can't focus, it's kind of like walking around without glasses and not being able to see very well. The issue was not so much that the rover couldn't actually operate the focus mechanism. The problem was that the rover didn't know when it was in focus. So the short-term solution... The short-term solution is that they would just take 5 different pictures.
Oh, that makes sense.
Well, yeah, just pick one that looks best.
Right, and then they'd send all those pictures back to Earth, and the humans would look at it and say, ah, that one. That one's in focus, right? So, obviously, this is a big problem.
That's not autofocus.
Not autofocus, no. Their autofocus is broken.
Transplanetary non-autofocus.
So, the question is, how do you fix something like that?
You go to Mars, and you get the screwdriver, and you're like...
No, what about now?
Software?
It's not easy to go to Mars, you know.
This and other obvious things from Ben Jeff.
Not a practical solution. Okay.
When they deploy hardware like this, like rovers like this, they make them as upgradable as possible. And you can imagine that this is completely nerve-wracking when you send a software update to your Mars rover. I mean, you know, software updates on my Mac break my Mac all the time. I have to go back to backups. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine this must be very nerve-wracking, but they did indeed successfully repair the autofocus mechanism by fixing a little glitch in the software. Now, the really cool thing, if you want to hear the really cool thing about this, the software that they fixed is really not particularly big. It's 40 kilobytes is the program that runs this entire instrument.
Now, I'm not a total geek, you guys, but that sounds small.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's not tiny, but it's not big. I mean, I was just talking about
file on your computer you don't bother deleting because it's not part of the problem.
Right. I mean, files that are 100 times that size you don't bother deleting. Angry Birds is like 100 times that size.
Or the
right?
NSA one's slightly larger.
Angry Birds is 1,000 times that size, I think.
Yeah, why are we talking like about Angry Birds so much this time?
I don't know. Ben's trying to plot it.
I brought it up. Hmm. Anyway, so that is my story. Lyle, tell me, how do I fix this car thing? I'd never heard about this.
You said something that's impossible. These can't be really that. It seems so elaborate. But you say this happens all the time?
This is happening all the time now. Actually, the elaborate one of people driving away with the car is less common.
Okay.
The more common one is you take one briefcase, you re-amplify the low frequency. You just re-amplify it from outside when someone's car is parked on the street outside their house. The fob responds with, hello, and they open the car. And then they don't actually do the secondary thing of stealing the car because they just rifle through and steal stuff. And yeah, this is happening all the time now.
Okay.
It's a pretty common
thing. It's just how they're getting their gum and quarters.
Well, whatever's in your car. I mean, if you leave something expensive in the car, it's really a problem. Yeah. So the solution is you don't want that fob responding like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two ways of dealing with this. One is you make sure that the fob can't respond by putting in what's called a Faraday cage. This is a small metal sack. In your house, your refrigerator works as a pretty good fob thing. So you could throw it in your freezer.
Yeah. That's why I can't see clearly into my refrigerator. There's that kind of a grid thing, and the grid is at a particular...
You're talking about your microwave.
Yeah, microwave.
Yes, that's a Faraday cage as well.
That's a Faraday cage.
The problem with putting in your microwave is what if you heat your tea and then your fob is destroyed?
I forgot.
Microwave would work as a Faraday cage, so
I
want to
carry around. I don't want to carry
any
around
any kind of metal box would pretty
microwave.
Much do it. The thing you can also do is... luckily, car companies have done something relatively intelligent. What happens if your fob runs out of power? If it runs out of power,
starts screaming?
It actually has a passive response that's quite weak that will actually still work most of the time. So what we can try to do is you can open up your fob. If you're concerned about this, you can open up your key fob, pull out the battery. Uh-huh. You will no longer be able to open your car from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
But it still should allow you to get into the car by getting out to close to the door. It'll ping it. It'll respond. You'll still be able to open the door. And then from inside, you might have to use the key that's normally hidden inside your fob. The long-term solution to this is the car companies are going to have to fix this problem.
Yeah.
It's a pretty serious one. I'm still putting it in my pocket and hoping I don't get targeted. I feel like, and I work and live at, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
I feel like it's, I love the convenience of this.
Yeah.
So probably won't leave stuff in my car as much, maybe.
That's why I say gum and quarters.
Yeah, so you could definitely put it in a small metal satchel. You can buy like a $14 thing on Amazon that's called
a
Faraday
case. Well, what about your Altoids tin?
Like that. That would pretty much might do it.
Here's another possibility. Rather than putting the fob in the Faraday cage, or why don't you just put yourself in the Faraday cage? Like,
you could just
like
live entirely
building,
inside a yeah. Faraday cage.
Just put some metal sheeting around your entire house.
Or just around your head.
Like tinfoil? Or?
Yeah. That would do it. Would that work?
It always comes back to tinfoil.
Only
tin
if you
foil.
Have your fob in your head as well.
Oh, gosh.
So try pulling the if you're concerned about this, try pulling the battery out of your fob and see if you can still get in your car and still start your car. And if you can, that pretty much alleviates the problem. Or put your fob in a little tiny satchel. How do you know if it's working? A little metal satchel. The way you'd know that is you'd go up to your car and try to get in. And your car, it shouldn't be able to open your car. So there you go.
You know what I want to do is install a little switch. The only problem is I don't have wireless entry.
That's true.
Anyway.
You could just go for an analog car. They still have a few of those on the streets.
They do have some of them.
Yeah. But I want to talk about going completely virtual.
Oculus Rift, baby.
Yeah.
That's what you want to talk about.
There's been some developments.
It's been pretty exciting to see what Oculus is doing. Oculus, of course, is a headset you put on your face. It covers you. It's a blindfold. And you see a 3D-scopic image that's generated by a computer. Mm-hmm. It was notably last year purchased by Facebook. So Facebook owns this technology. And there is now this Story Studio, which is, some people are calling Story Studio the Pixar of the VR world.
Ooh.
So it's a movie making experience, which is actually making movies for Oculus. So you step into the world of the movie, and you as a camera person are kind of moved around, but also you can look around. It's kind of a neat type of experience.
It's protagonist eye view movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a first person movie instead of a first person game.
Fascinating.
So the first one they released was Lost, and Lost,
I'm guessing you're lost.
Well, you're walking. I haven't experienced it. You're walking through a virtual world. You're flying, mm-hmm. walking through a virtual world. Mm-hmm. The thing about Oculus that's very clear when you try it is that you remove yourself from the current existence and you put on a blindfold and headphones, and you're completely isolated in a virtual reality. And the thing about those virtual realities is they're not social, right?
Mm-hmm. They are so you alone having an experience with the landscape.
Right. So what the Story Studio is doing now with their Lost is they're allowing for multiple people to go through the story at the same time.
What?
So you and someone else sit in a room with Oculus on and experience a film where you're both characters in it and you're doing it together, which is a very different shift. And what gets really exciting about virtual reality is when it's a reality with other people.
Mm. And but they're prescribed realities, right?
Oh, yeah, completely. It's not like this is a narrated thing, just like you go see a movie. It's like right? Anyway, it's kind of exciting to see this because, of course, I'm moved a lot by speculative fiction, and the Star Trek, of course, has the holodeck.
Yeah, we
which
all
is very
like
much
the holodeck,
right? We like the holodeck.
Yeah, we want
the
holodeck.
Only difference is people don't look so goofy because they don't have
right. You look ridiculous.
Big helmets on there.
It's okay. You get virtually rendered, so then you look fine. You can look like a dragon, anything you want. And of course, there's a lot of films that talk about, or books and speculative fiction that talk about this idea of a virtual reality, which actually people engage with at a heavy level, and seeing this kind of quality and storytelling using VR gets exciting. I mean, the images, the stills and video that I see in the Lost film, it's a really amazing looking film, completely virtual, and you get to walk through it in a different way than you'd normally see a film.
And so when it can be a social experience, where do people go? Would they gather in one spot to watch this movie together, or would they be all in their individual rooms? Is there some prevailing thought about that?
You'd have to experience this in a place where two VR systems worked in the same dark environment.
Okay.
So it definitely requires multiple of these headsets. But
so we're not
in mind,
yet at the IMAX level
reality. This is not a large piece of equipment. This is a cheap piece of equipment, right? Mm-hmm. This is like a monitor to your computer kind of cost. And it requires a computer, of course. But the idea about virtual reality normally is you don't have to be local to each other to experience a similar experience. Mm-hmm. So the removing yourself, your location, and making it you be anywhere is part of the VR storyline.
Got it. So sorry, movie theaters, basically.
Yeah, pretty much.
Not helping.
Now, if you do this, you do want to make, if you're sitting in the same room, you want to make sure you're sitting far enough away from each other. Because, you know, you don't want to flail
and hit
each other in the face.
Oh,
and the other thing about the system, they're also using sound as well that is spatial sound. So your ears hear stereoscopic sound that is a different direction. When you turn your head, the sound also shifts so that you can experience, it feels very much like you're there, I guess is the best way to explain it.
That just sparked up all of my desires to be a Foley That's an alternate reality for Bonnie Jean Proch. She's a Foley artist. Go do some 3D sound for Oculus. It sounds great, fantastic. Man. VR hasn't been around that long.
It has, actually, Bonnie. It's been around forever and a day.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
I know. Because VR is the first time people started seeing computer imagery. They're like, what if we put this right in front of our face and that's all you can see? And so, in fact, there's this wonderful... I'm going to recommend people go to the GeekSpeak website and see this wonderful collection of photographs of people's VR systems from the early days to now and what they look like.
The early days being like the 80s or what?
Bonnie, yeah. 1963 was the first like glasses headset worn on your face. By inventor Hugo Gernsback.
Yeah. Okay.
And he discussed it 30 years before.
Geekspeak.org, folks.
Yeah,
Geekspeak.org. Yeah, I guess we'll have to check it out. That's a web extra. Do we have time for a short story about Earls?
Speaking of sound, Google Tone, it's a Chrome plugin. It's experimental, but basically, if you have an old-style modem and it makes that sound, it's actually sending information, even though it sounds like static to us. Google Tone will let you hit a button on your web browser and it'll send out sound that other computers can hear and go to the same URL that you're at.
Oh, really? So you can dog whistle your way to being in the same URL.
It's like at the beginning of the show, like, oh man, can you send me the link to the show page of the Google Doc? Yeah, sure. Right?
Okay.
Except it's higher than humans can hear. So that's cool. That's pretty good.
So in that way, it is for dogs. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so reuse our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi and cite your sources. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. And as we said, to find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, do visit us, won't you, at GeekSpeak.org or drop us a line. We're at geeks@geekspeak.org, or you could contact us on Twitter. We're at KUSPGeeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe. And thank you for being here for the May 30th, 2015 episode of GeekSpeak.